evening. I'm Leonard. I'm an alcoholic. And thank you, Bill, for asking me to come and speak tonight. You know, by the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had a drink since July 3rd of 1996, and I'm very grateful for that. You know, the road to recovery I remember what it was like for me when I first got here. I got here this earlier and I was talking with, I think it was Mike and some of the other members about what it was like, you know, I had to come to AA by way of a treatment program, because in my head I remembered AA didn't work, because I had tried it 6 months before and I had spent years trying to control my drinking and do everything I could in my own power to not drink. And one of the things I did was I showed up to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous pretty much dazed. I didn't remember what happened previously, the night before. This was the one of many, many times when this had happened over the course of my drinking. And I could tell that my drinking was getting progressively worse. I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I immediately identified with some of the things that the members were talking about. And I can remember them talking about how they felt. And what rung true with me was that I felt indescribably alone, like I was abandoned. Like nobody understood me. And I was in this huge pool of self-pity. And I can remember some of the members talking about that hopelessness. I felt at that point in time that maybe this was the answer. But in relatively short order, I went to a few more meetings and I was able to put a couple of days together without drinking. And then I continued to try to come to meetings, but then I tried to drink at the same time. And I found that didn't work real well. So I had to make a choice, and of course, I chose drinking. And I went out for another 6 months and let alcohol do its work to get me back here by way of a treatment program. And I can remember being at work, and for me at this point in time in my life, getting to work, I arrived at 8 o'clock or thereabouts. I had a real problem with being on time at work at that time. But I would get to work, and it wouldn't be until about 11 o'clock until I cleared. I couldn't remember many times, you know, what had happened, how many I had drink I had had the night before. And I can remember being, you know, getting ready in the morning and being in the shower and just, you know, trying to take a count of, you know, okay, where did I go? How much did I drink? I was only going to have a couple of beers, you know, on the way home from Fresno to Kingsburg. And, of course, in my drinking, you know, you get from Fresno to Kingsburg by way of Porterville or Lemoore. And I would end up in these places. I had no idea where I was. I would have blackouts. And I wouldn't know how I got home. Sometimes I would wake up, I would come to in a blackout. And I can remember, being an alcoholic, I loved the lie. And one of the lies that I loved was I loved the fog. You know, most people around here don't like driving in the fog. But I loved the fog because they couldn't see me. And I can remember coming to from a blackout. I looked down, I came to looking at the speedometer. It was reading 80 miles an hour. And I looked up, and I could see 15 feet in front of my vehicle, and I was an unguided missile. I had no idea where I was when I got home. And this happened numerous times. I wasn't always so lucky. In many respects, I managed to dodge the bullet in that. In my experience, I never ended up with a DUI. I never ended up in jail. And I shared that with an old timer who recently passed away. Was one of our good friends in the Kingsburg area. And he said, "Well, Leonard," he said, "you're a protected drinker. What the hell? You make this stuff up as you go along." And he said, "No, you were a protected drinker. You didn't, you know, you didn't have to experience, you know, a lot of the stuff that a lot of us have had to go through. You know, be grateful for that." But Ed was a good guy, and I'm going to really miss him quite a bit. He was, he had quite an impact on a lot of us in the Kingsburg area. But, you know, I can remember, coming to just trying to count, okay, where did I, retrace my steps? Where did I go? What did I do? Who was I with? And I couldn't remember. Over time, I could remember some things, but again, by 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock in the morning, I was barely getting to work because I just wasn't capable of being there at work. I was so clouded and so foggy. So, but anyway, the getting to the AA program, I ended up going to a treatment program because, you know, I looked into it, I checked my insurance, and I thought, well, this is going to work. It costs money, so this has got to work. And so I ended up going into a treatment program, and I was really grateful that this treatment program, I was grateful after the fact, that this treatment program was real clear that they were not going to get me sober. That I was going to need to, they were going to teach me a little bit about my disease, and I started hearing that word a lot. They told me that they'd teach me a little bit about myself, but I was going to need to get to meetings with Alcoholics Anonymous in order to attain sobriety. And I can remember the director of that program, you know, clearly telling me that. And so I had gone into, I'd gone to work, I cleared up enough, I made a phone call, and I went, and this wasn't the first time I went for an assessment at a program. This was actually the only one I ever followed through on and showed up. And so I went, and the director told me a little bit about what he thought about my drinking, heard my experience. He told me, he said, "Leonard," he said, "if you really want to beat this thing," he said, "you have a progressive disease. It's going to keep getting and getting bigger over time." And he described it in terms of that I could understand. And because when I first started drinking, I mean, drinking was fun. Drinking made me feel like everything didn't matter. Like everything was okay. Like I was comfortable in my own skin. Because I lived a life where I was just not, I was always, you know, uncomfortable of being who I was. And but alcohol, when I took that first drink, it was just like, boom. You know, and as I continued to drink, I remember real early in drinking, in just out of high school, this guy looked at me, and I was drinking my second beer, and he just looked at me, he started laughing. I said, "You know, what's so funny?" He goes, "You're different." He said, "When you drink, you change." He said, "You're different." And everything would be up right with me, you know, right with the world, and I was okay. And you hear it in the meetings, you know, other alcoholics would describe the same thing, but, you know, I felt like I could dance better. I felt like I could communicate better. I felt like I, you know, looked better. And I attained this, this false sense of confidence, but alcohol did something for me early on. Over time, and very seductively, alcohol started doing to me, and I could not pinpoint when that started taking place. But I could see from my history over time that that things were progressively getting worse, that my scrapes were getting a little bit more severe, that I dodged so many bullets. By the time I graduated from high school, I had had two alcohol-related accidents in my parents' car. One was kind of like not really an accident. I just kind of like nicked the bridge. And I didn't think that should count. But that bridge is, I actually had to go over that bridge on the way over here from Fresno, and I was glad to see that it was still standing. I hadn't taken it down yet. But another time I ended up taking out the side of the car, you know, going through, thinking the car was a tractor. So I went through some vines and took out the side of the car. But those were the beginning of accidents that I would have, that I would walk away from. There were accidents where, and situations where the police were there, but I was able to talk my way out of it. And I was able to maintain control. Nothing ruins a good buzz like seeing those police lights. And I ended up being able to compose myself enough to walk away and to appear like I was all right, even though I was fully intoxicated. And it was just a gift, you know. And so over time, I could see that my drinking had progressed. But the director of that treatment program, he said, you're going to need to get to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, are you willing to do whatever it takes to get sober? And I said, yes. He goes, okay. And he talked a little bit more about, you know, some of my behaviors and the things that I was doing when I was drinking and how they kind of fell outside of this circle. He drew a circle and he put dots all over this, inside the circle, and he put a bunch of them outside the circle. And he said, this is your boundary. These are your moral values, your boundaries that you have. He said, and some of the stuff that you're talking about doing fall outside of those boundaries. He says, you're either going to need to do one of two things. You're either going to need to expand those boundaries so that what you're doing is okay, or you're going to need to stop drinking, because what you're doing when you're drinking is falling outside of it. And so he talked about my behavior, and he made it relevant to me. He said, so what I want you to do right now, we're going to look a little bit more into your insurance and getting into the program. He said, but I want you to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And right there I froze. I said, well, look, I just got over here from work. They don't even know I'm gone. I had one guy covering for me. And I can't go. He said, Leonard, he said, I just asked you if you'd be willing to do whatever it took to get sober. And you told me yes. He said, and immediately when I asked you to start doing something, suggested you participate in your own recovery, he said, you balked. And you started making excuses. And you started hedging. He said, I suggest you go to a meeting and don't call us anonymous. He said, I asked you that, didn't I? Yeah. He goes, he said, are you going to go? I said, I'm going to go. So I did. I left there. I think this is it. And, you know, I said I'd do it. You know, I'm going to get fired. And so I went to Fresno Fellowship when it was off of Blackstone. And that was when you could smoke in the meeting room. And you walk in there, and you couldn't see the other side of the room, you know. And you had this big tule fog of smoke in there. But I went to that meeting, and then my head's running, you know. People know I don't smoke, and they're going to smell this on me, and people are going to ask where I've been. And I got back to work, and I was sure I was dead. And I got back to work, and nobody said anything. And so I continued to go to this program. I went back, and they said, okay, you know, sign on the line. They said, you ready to do everything that we're asking you to do? I said, yeah. I said, okay, you're going to have three meetings to go to this week and for this treatment program. I said, you're going to need to go to three meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, what? I said, you know, why don't you guys tell me that before I sign this thing? I said, you know, I'm a busy guy. You know, I'm important. I got stuff to do. I'm a member in my community of standing, and I've got commitments, and I don't have time to do this. And he just said, no. He says, this is part of the requirement of this program. You're going to need to do this. And you know what? You're going to need to get this little card signed. And one of the counselors in there would always call it the Get Well card. So, you know, I proceeded to go ahead and do that, and I was really ticked off, because I kind of felt like I've been snowed into this thing, and I was resentful. I started off going into this program, I was really resentful. And over the course of time, I had some good people in that program that were in recovery. One of the guys in the program got to know my story. I was telling him about how, you know, what it was like for me, what my drinking patterns were, and et cetera. And Leonard, he said, you know, you hide your drinking? I said, no, I don't hide my drinking. I mean, I drink in front of people. It's not like I'm not hiding my drinking. He said, you know, he talked about going home from Fresno to Kingsburg and taking all of these different routes, you know, way out of the way. And you had, you know, your plan on where you were going to go and the different routes you would take. You'd repeat them, but you wouldn't take the same route every day. So, well, isn't that hiding your drinking? No, not hiding. I mean, I honestly, you know, I couldn't see where that was hiding my drinking. I mean, it didn't make sense. He said, Leonard, he said, you know, you talked about going home, and on the way home, you tell, you know, when you went straight from Fresno to Kingsburg, and you got home, and you told your wife, you know, she asked you how many you had, and you told her you had two beers, you didn't tell her that they were too coarse. I said, well, yeah. He said, that's not hiding your drinking? I said, maybe. He said, you know, and you have this refrigerator that you keep all of your beer out in the back. And, you know, you go out there and you drink by yourself. And I said, well, I do work. And he said, yeah, but he said, when you start drinking, you stop working. And, you know, and so I said, well, yeah. He goes, that's not hiding your drinking. I said, I don't know. I was getting confused at that time. And then he said, well, you know, what about all those, when you're coming home and you're driving along and you have, you know, a container, you finish your beer and you shove it under your seat, you know how many panicked alcoholics on their way home, and you know, people lose piles of cans and bottles that are on the side of the road, and I always think of me when I see those things, because I think of some poor guy at 4 in the morning pulling all those suckers out and throwing, dodging them before he gets home. But he said, you know, stuffing all those cans under your seat and bottles, he said, that's not drinking? That's not hiding your drinking? And I said, no, that's prudent. I mean, who the heck is going to leave an empty alcohol container on their car seat? You know, what if a cop sees it? He said, well, that's not hiding your drinking. And I said, maybe it is. He said, you know, Leonard, he said, I want you to think. Think about what you have at your house and your patterns and stuff. He said, I've heard enough of your story. He said, do you have any alcohol in your house right now? I said, nope. He says, none. He said, nope. I said, I'm... He said, think about it. I said, you know what? I said, I do. I said, I've got a case of wine and champagne. He said, what you got a case of wine and champagne for? I said, well, you know, I belong to an organization, and sometimes we have fundraisers and stuff, and we had it one here at my house, and it's there. It's out in the back in that garage. He said, think, do you have any more alcohol in your house? I said, no. He goes, think about it. And I said, you know what? You know that refrigerator? I said, I do. I've got one beer in there, one Silver Bullet. He goes, you got a Silver Bullet. And he said, He said, did you ever hear the story of Superman? And I said, everybody's heard the story of Superman. He said, do you remember what it was that rendered Superman powerless? And I said, well, yeah, kryptonite. Everybody knows that. You know, Superman. He goes, do you think Superman kept a 12-ounce can of kryptonite in his refrigerator? And I said, no, I see where you're going with this, Tom. And I, yeah, no, Superman wouldn't do that. He goes, that's right. Yeah, and he's Superman, and you're just Leonard. But I needed guys to talk to me about my patterns and to make sense, have things make sense to me. Because honestly, when I came here, I mean, I look back and I was pretty knotted up. I was pretty knotted up mentally. I was pretty knotted up emotionally. When I finally got here and started working these steps, it was kind of like a floodgate that happened. And a floodgate of all of these emotions that I'd had. And I can remember the first year in this program and working, rigorously working these steps and getting into and buying into this program, because the more I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, the more I knew that you guys were telling the truth. Because the stuff that you were sharing in meetings and laughing about was the stuff that I was trying to keep hidden. And I knew you were telling the truth because you were doing the same things that I was doing. And so I came to believe that this thing worked. That you guys were not doing anything other than sharing your experience. And you looked and you appeared to be relatively happy. And it looked like in your life, your lives were relatively useful. I mean, you know, you weren't winning the World Series or anything, but you were doing okay. You were suiting up and showing up for life. And when I got here, I wasn't doing that so well. You know, I was good at pretending like I was doing that well. But I was spending a lot of energy. I liked what one guy in a meeting shared with me, and I identified with it. He said his drinking was like, and when he drank, it was like the picture of the swan moving across the still lake without even making a wake. And he said, this swan is just gliding across. He said, but if you looked underneath the water, you see those legs just going and going. And he said, that's what his drinking was like. And I identified with that because I was spending a lot of energy trying to make things look like they were okay. You know, and things weren't okay. Because things were happening to me that when I would come to, and when I would remember some of the things that I did, and when the fog would clear, I would go through periods of, why in the heck did you do that? You said you weren't going to do that. You promised yourself that you were just going to come straight home. You know, I was married and had two children. I was... for a period of time, when I started to realize I had a problem, I drove a school bus, and it's hard to keep the gig up, you know, when people, especially in that field, know that you got a problem, and I came to realize that there were a lot of guys that knew that I was having a problem. And one guy even came up to me who was a supervisor and asked me, he said, do you have a drinking problem? I said, no, of course not. He said, well, we had an administrator say that, you know, you smell like alcohol. I said, you know, come to think of it, I was washing my car and I went in between runs and I had a couple beers. It was like at 10 o'clock in the morning. And he goes, okay, he said, you're going to need to not do that. But the reality was is that it was worse than that. It was always worse than what I made it out to be. Doc would ask me, you know, how many beers you drink a day, Hunter? A couple? You know? Okay. And then I would try to ask about my drinking by asking others about their drinking, you know? I kind of go to the back door, you know, circumlocution. I'd say, you know, in fact, I even asked the doctor one time. He kept asking me about my drinking periodically. I said, you ever think you drink too much, Doc? And he said, sometimes too much, sometimes not enough. That was me. I said, that's me, Doc. I'm okay, too. And I would try to find reasons that people would give me that, you know, that I could identify with that would keep me drinking. I remember asking my cousin, who I knew had gotten sober, and I didn't know how, but I knew he didn't drink anymore. And I was talking to him about my drinking, and I said, well, Dave, you know, you think I should stop drinking? And he looked at me and goes, Leonard, he says, if you didn't have to stop drinking, why would you? Well, that makes sense. I don't have to stop drinking. And so I would want to rationalize and justify in my head why it was okay for me to keep drinking, even though all the evidence was pointing to the fact that that I was having problems. But what I didn't realize was as time went on, I had lost control of my drinking. I could no longer drink like a normal person. One guy in the program talked about it early on. He said he went from a cucumber to a pickle. Said he would never be able to go back to becoming a cucumber again. And, you know, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. And those are the kinds of things that I started to hear early on. And so I understood about this chronic aspect of this disease of alcoholism, that I was going to have it for the rest of my life. And I wasn't real comfortable with that. But at the time that I finally accepted that, I was already in this program, and I was already starting to do the deal here and take the suggestions that people were offering me. So I learned about the progressiveness of this disease and that it's chronic, that I'll have it for the rest of my life. And I didn't like that at first. I remember early on, I did not like the fact that other people could drink and I could not. But I did come to the point of accepting that that's okay today. You know, I truly believe, and I am okay with the fact that drinking is okay. There is not a problem with drinking. There is a problem with me drinking, you see, because my body is different and I react differently to alcohol. And this phenomenon of craving kicks in that doesn't happen to the normal drinker. And then I just want another. It's not like I want, you know, to just hit a beer truck and just be, you know, immersed in alcohol. I just wanted the next one, and I wanted the next one, and I wanted the next one. And before I knew it, I was coming home in the morning, and I was racing the sunrise, and I could see the silhouette of the mountain. And I didn't know that I had lost control. I didn't know that I was sick. And what I heard early on and I really liked and I was comfortable with was that I wasn't a bad person trying to get good. I was a sick person trying to get well. And that I was told that if I continued to come to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and if I continued to work with a sponsor and to get a big book, to read that big book, to work the steps and to get into service, you know, that I would have a shot. At a life free of alcohol, free of drinking. And for me, that wasn't something that I could imagine. I couldn't imagine stringing more than 3 days together sober by the time I came here. And those of you that took those newcomerships, you know, keep coming back because you know what? That first 30 days for me was a long, long time. And I can remember getting that 30-day shift. And I hadn't had 30 days for 15 years. And I think the last time I had 30 days, I had white-knuckled it through Lent or something like that. But I came into these rooms and people talked about, again, getting into service was really big in whether you're putting away chairs at the end of the meeting, okay, wiping down tables, washing out the coffee pot, whatever it was, do something to get outside of yourself. You know, humble yourself a little bit to get into service. And eventually, over time, by virtue of working these steps, you're going to be able to pass this thing on. And I'm really grateful. I had a lot of guys that came into my life when I really needed them because, as I mentioned, I was pretty emotionally knotted up. And that first year, I was like a wet hanky. I mean, I couldn't not even talk about my emotions and the anger and the pain that I had and that I was carrying, you know, without choking up over it. And it was a tough thing to do. I learned early on that you didn't do that, you know. But it was here that my first sponsor, who I had nothing in common with, who came from a completely different background, ex-convict, big tough guy, when I was reading my third step to him and choked up with tears and going over the stuff that I had written down what he had asked me to write about. I couldn't even look him in the eye, because I was embarrassed about it. But I was doing it, and I did what he'd asked me to do. And I ended up finishing, and I looked up at him, and this big tough guy that I had nothing in common with was crying. And I learned that I could be a human being in Alcoholics Anonymous. As time went on, I had gone back to school. I decided to go into teaching. One would think that teaching would require some semblance of organizational skills and planning skills. But you'd be surprised, I actually developed a pretty good reputation in my field as a teacher. A lot of my best stuff I do on the fly. So I've learned to kind of be flexible and just kind of, just let go and try to do my best, and suit up and show up. I like the field that I'm in. I get to be in service to special kids. They've taught me a lot about life that I don't know if I've learned anywhere else, but I'm very, very loving and giving kids. My wife and I have been married for almost 30 years, and she stuck with me. It's amazing, the stuff that she forgave me, and the pain that I brought into her life and the kids. When I got here, my kids didn't like me very much, and understandably so. But today, we have a much better relationship. We have a grandchild. I cannot tell you the joy that I have in being a grandfather. I love it. I absolutely love it. There's nothing like it. I was gone. I mean, I was there physically, but I was gone for my kids growing up. And it is very, very different as a program with this little one. And I wouldn't have that today. Had I still been drinking. I don't even like to think about where I would be, but I know that that I wouldn't have what I have in terms of the relationship that I've got today. And that's what AA for me and working the steps was about. It's about giving up, it's about cleaning up, it's about making up, and it's about growing. And those steps are in order for a reason. And I needed to surrender. Those first three steps are about me giving up and surrendering to my any control or power I think I may have over drinking and alcohol. And then surrendering my will and my life over my higher power. And then the next steps are about, doing some cleaning up. And I get to take that moral inventory. The next steps are about making up and writing relationships and being in right relationships. Today, money and things, they're important, but the most important things are right relationships. Being in right relationships with those around me and with my higher power. And it's really funny because I know I still even today will want to try to say that I'm in right relationship with my higher power, and I can be real disjointed with those that are right around me. And when I do that, I know that I need to, there's step work I need to do. And so we have, the maintenance steps to do some growing, because once we do the surrendering and the giving up and the cleaning up and the making up, we have a chance to start growing up in this program. And that may sound harsh if you're new, but, there was a lot of immaturity in my life. And I can remember talking about my drinking at the end to somebody. I talked about this, my drinking party. I always refer to it as party. And he looked at me and he says, Larry says, when people talk about parties, they usually are associated with fun. And you're partying, you know, you're talking about a lot of painful stuff. See, there's a disjoint here. He said, and it helped me realize that I was still talking at 36 years old of my drinking at partying with vocabulary of a, you know, 16-year-old. You know, and I started to realize, I started to help, as I did, you know, got a chance to do some growing in this program, which we get to do, we choose to do, you know, just participate in life and be a part of, you know, when I drank and when I was in that pain and that isolation and that loneliness, I was always apart from, you know, and by virtue of this program and being sober today, I get to be a part of, you know, I'm not better than or different than, you know, I'm just a part of. And I like what, I think we plan to talk about, because we don't get to be anything, we don't graduate from this program and elevate others and to be other than a basic human being, you know. And that's what I get to do, is to be a basic human being today. Deal with all of my character defects, which I get to work on. And I have this one character defect that I've been struggling with, and I shared it with my confessor. And he said, well, you know, some of our character defects are pretty well ingrained. You'll probably be wrestling with that one until about 10 minutes after you die. So he says, you know, kind of get used to making do with, and which is, for me, you know, the sixth step, you know, separates the men from the boys. I get to keep working at turning things over. And I appreciate, the fact that we had a chance that you gave me an opportunity to share a little bit about my experience if you're new, this program works. You know, it works if you work it. It won't if you don't. Keep coming back. Thanks.